is Art Focus with host Ava Lake. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Native American Youth and Family Center's Micro Enterprise Program, presenting the NAYA Marketplace, where Northwest Native small business vendors and artisans display beadwork, jewelry, pottery, and more. Saturday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard. Information at nayapdx.org. Vendor information by email to cjw@nayapdx.org. And by Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 18th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade art, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at Southwest Ankeny and Nato Park Way in Waterfront Park. Information at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream. Hang him on.
Good morning. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. My name is Ava Lake, and I have with me the perfect guest for a David Bowie, Andy Warhol intro, and that's Jim Riswalt. Jim, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, and thanks for playing David Bowie's song about Andy Warhol.
Right. That's kind of a special significance for you, right?
Oh, I'd say so.
You'd say so? It seems like maybe it's not quite a year ago. I don't know. I have interviewed you once before, right?
I think it was 1947.
1947. But I know that you and I had a big Andy Warhol moment right on the air. Like, I didn't know beforehand that you were such a, not only Andy Warhol, but David Bowie, both of those. We just went on and on about it.
Well, the first concert I ever saw, I was 14 years old. I was the single most unhip teenager in Seattle, Washington. And a friend took me to a concert from this guy from England, he said. His name is David Bowie. I never heard of Bowie. I thought he died in the Alamo and had a knife named after him.
Right.
This was 1972. There was about 80 people in the audience. It was the Ziggy Stardust tour. And I went to that concert, and my life changed.
Your life changed. Did you want to look like him? Did you be?
I wanted to be him.
You wanted to be him? But did you end up like cutting your hair and doing all those great things?
I did all that stuff, much to the chagrin of my father, who's from South Dakota, and David Bowie doesn't fly in South Dakota. Or at least 1972, David Bowie didn't fly in South Dakota.
It didn't. But since then, has he now said, you know what, I realize that you were right?
No.
Oh, darn it. So now let's talk a little bit. I think I should mention that Jim Riswalt was the former creative director for a Portland, Oregon-based advertising agency, Wieden Kennedy. He's an instructor at the agency has a kind of experimental advertising school, yes?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, but yeah. WK-12. It's a school masquerading as an advertising agency masquerading as a school.
Cool. And you're also an artist.
Well, some people might take issue with that.
That's debatable. That part's debatable. So let's just start a little bit by, I want to just talk about your last show, and because it's kind of still ongoing, even though that exhibition is actually over. You had a show at Ogden Gallery called Art for Oncologists. Let's just talk about the name. How did you come up with this?
Well, I've spent the last 13 years of my life with oncologists. I've battled two different cancers. And, you know, I think a lot of my earlier work with the Hitlers and the Maos and all the bad people were my way of dealing with cancer indirectly.
Uh-huh.
So this one, I thought that I should deal with it more head on. And have it just straight about mm-hmm. the experience, not only for me, but for friends of mine that have been through the ringer with it far worse than I ever have. So, you know, it's hard for me to use words like celebration,
mm-hmm.
but I really think this show ended up being a celebration for, you know, oncologists who are here to keep some of us alive and, you know, their patients.
And the survivors.
Yeah.
Yes. So, and also, we should add that there was something in this exhibition that is going to be in the Portland Art Museum. I kind of want to put that front and center, and we'll end the show with it as well. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the world's largest candy dish. It was the centerpiece of the show. It was a manufactured sculpture. It was called A Big Bowl of Chemotherapies and One Zofran. Zofran is the medicine that they give you so you don't throw up as much when you have chemotherapy. But it was filled with, it was 5 feet by 5 feet and about 3 feet deep. And it was filled with 10 different large hearts, 15 by 15 inches by 5 inches, with various chemotherapies on them. They were like candy hearts, but with chemotherapies. Most of the chemos were chemos that helped save friends of mine's life, including my own. I do like myself. Mm-hmm. Ask anybody. And then some very famous chemotherapies in the history of fighting this disease.
So these candies, were they real candies in the dish? Were they plastic? And I guess I'd like to know, like, how did you make this?
They were, well, of course, it's like everything. I had somebody else do it.
Yes. Yes.
They're made from high-density polyurethane, uh-huh. And then they were coated in resin, and then they were painted with automobile paint. And a company named Additive, who no longer exists, but Rob Arps, who runs the company, and Tim Caitlin, who is on his own right now, were the primary guys to make sure that
manufacture that right.
This worked. It took 2 years of work to get them right.
So you had thought of this at least a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Wow.
And I worked for 2 years on the show.
You worked for 2 years.
And it went through many, many permutations.
From plastic sculpture things to things on print, or what do you mean by changes?
Well, first the show was kind of, I guess, cheeky, mm-hmm. or more ironic.
Which is more your style, right?
Yeah, and, you know, it was borrowing things from old shows like Mao fighting cancer or Mussolini fighting cancer, whatever. And I looked at it, you know, and I said, well, this is fine and dandy for me. But I thought that this show had to be about something bigger than me, about the community of survivors and the people that kept them alive.
Mm-hmm. So you changed the personalities that were involved? Or?
Yeah, I made it celebratory, and I think the person that was most, I guess, I don't know if bemused is the right word, or surprised by the tone of the show was the man who saved my life, Brian Druker, who at the opening quipped, you know, I think I've been to every one of Jim's opening, and this is the first one where I don't think I'm going to have to apologize to anybody for saving his life.
So it had much more of a positive, inclusive vibe to it, for lack of a better word, as opposed to the other shows which could chap someone's hide, almost every one of them.
Yes.
Yes.
Less snarky.
Less snarky. So I want to also talk about just the aesthetic. One thing I saw was these beautiful white images. So you took those pills, you took the pharmaceuticals, which, I mean, we could, you know, trace back to somebody like Damien Hirst. But you, of course, because of your history with them, you completely changed the conversation of that. And then they were, at the same time, this really glowy, sort of neo-minimalist art object.
Well, thank you. I did. My friend Richard Spear says, what are you trying to be now, a minimalist? I mean, I kept it very, very simple, which is hard for me to do. I tend to overdo everything.
Uh-huh.
But the aesthetic was to both be clinical, eerie, and I think a sense of magic as well. I mean, every piece was predominantly white, and all the frames were white. All the screen prints were white with very little type on them, and the only thing that wasn't pure white was Don Quixote on a bag of chemotherapy in an old Spanish frame.
Mm-hmm. And, well, let's just keep with the white for a moment, and then we'll get to some of these other pieces. So now, is it possible that you reached that white conclusion because you had the 2 years? I mean, you had so much. That's a long time for you, kind of. I know when I first met you and you had done the...
I did a show every 2 weeks.
Yeah, you did. You had like six shows in 2 years or something like that. Yeah, so you had... This was really different from the start because it was going to take so long to come to all of your conclusions.
Well, I think, again, even though this show wasn't about me per se or my demons or dealing how I dealt with certain reoccurrences of diseases in my life, this was, you know, bigger for me. And I just had to keep pinching myself to say, no, that's too much about you and not enough about... A word that I tried to avoid in the show, but it's hard to avoid it. And that word was hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, it's a four-letter word.
Yes.
Can I say that on here?
Hope, you can say
hope. Is that
hope?
A four-letter word I can say? Yes, or the FCC is not going to get Cabo in trouble?
That's right. Yeah, I think they still allow hope.
But you know, it comes down.
Right.
For better or worse, it comes down to that in dealing with this disease.
So the aesthetic, the white aesthetic, kind of like, you know, it was almost like it had to be because you, in your process of, no, I don't want to do this, and no, I don't want to do that, you kind of arrived at this kind of unpredictable place.
I kept carrying things, throwing things out.
Mm-hmm. Unusual process for you.
Yeah, because I usually tend to add too much.
Now, just to stick with the drugs for a moment here.
Ooh, drugs.
I know. But these were all pharmaceuticals for cancer, yes?
Yes.
I mean, I saw so many words that I thought, whoa, he's familiar with all of these words, very familiar. And
well,
that's part of the
reason that it took 2 years is to do research on this. A lot of my research was done. I called my oncologist, was my research assistant. He said, you should read this book, you should read that, you know. A book called The Emperor of All Maladies, which is the biography of cancer, was a great source of resource to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the subject. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It's the biography of cancer. It's going to be Ken Burns' next documentary. There's a whole chapter devoted to Drucker and the develop of Gleevec that saved my life. But the research and learning all those words, as I said in the artist statement, I hadn't used so many big words since I was writing philosophy papers about Hegel in the early 80s.
Right. So a word about your doctor and Gleevec. So, because there's a piece on that, yes?
Yes, one of the hearts is Gleevec. There is a portrait I did of Brian as
in
365
days.
Gleevec. Hearts, because you have to take the medicine every day.
Uh-huh.
So you could, and that pill turned a disease that was basically chemotherapy resistant and a death sentence unless you could survive something as brutal as a bone marrow transplant with a, you know, you have 2 to 4 years into a disease that they tell you you'll probably get hit by a bus before this disease gets you.
Okay. So this is what happened for you.
Yeah.
So this was developed here?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm waiting to get hit by a bus.
Okay. So now this particular piece is very interesting because you've also in it tackled another construct of minimalist art, which is the grid. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a grid with the Gleevec in each one of the squares, mm-hmm. right? So I mean, was it purposeful for you that you were kind of using these sort of like abstract, you know, minimalist abstract art constructs to tell, to narrate cancer?
Of course. I know a little more about art than I pretend not to.
Oh, I know that you do, but it's not like you really took on those things, I think, in your previous exhibitions. How about that?
Not at all. Yes.
Right.
This was, I told a lot of people that this show will surprise you. And I think what surprised most people was the tone of it, you know, instead of being snarky and, you know, just irony on top of irony. Not that you can say that there is no irony in this show. It's just at a lot smaller dose than usual.
Yes.
I'd like to tell people that I've gone from the Hitler art guy to the cancer art guy.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Ava Lake, and this is Art Focus. If you want more information about this show, you can go to kboo.fm/artfocus, and you can see links to my guests and past interviews. I've been here about 5 years. I also share this show now with Joseph Gallivan. We are doing the show every other week together, and I'm so grateful for him. So he's also interviewing here at KBOO. I have with me today Jim Riswold, who has his own website, by the way, RISWOLD, Jim Riswold, and you can see images that we're talking about. He's also shows at Ogden Gallery, so Ogden Gallery has images and artist statements, that kind of thing, from the past show. We were talking about Art for Oncologists, which was his last show, and one of the pieces will be in the museum, Portland Art Museum. And we should also say that all of the... Is this true that the proceeds from your exhibition, what happened with that?
Well, I always planned to donate the money to Brian in his relentless pursuit of this disease. And then on top of that, well, you know, at the same time, Phil Knight challenged Dr. Drew Corneau, HSU, if you can raise $500 million in 2 years, starting December 15th, I will match it. If you come up $1 short, I will not match it. So, I mean, I guess in the best of all possible worlds, I would have sold $500 million worth of art that night and just handed Brian a check and call it a day.
Right.
That didn't happen.
That hasn't happened. So you're still working on that.
Yes, I'm slightly south of $500 million in sales.
So you have a few pieces in this exhibition, though, that are not a pill, and they're not a print. They're sculptural, no? Like, what about, or maybe they're a photograph. You have the one, there's a few that are not pills. Tell me what they are. There's one where you've got, is it a bag of piss on the radio. is it a bag of that?
There were a couple of photos that Ray Gordon took of me after second bout with a different cancer that procedure didn't go quite according to plan, and basically, a number of people told me, I looked like I swallowed a grenade. So when I got home from a week and a half in the hospital, I had Ray shoot what my broken body looked like, with staples, bruises, scars, pick lines, and catheters.
Ray who, please? Ray Gordon?
Ray Gordon.
Okay, yes.
And we just set up a oilcloth in my apartment. My mom, who was taking care of me, had to leave the room or she was going to faint.
Aww.
And Ray took these pictures of me.
And there's two. One is one you have like a maybe drawstring pants on, and another nothing?
And there's also a close-up that even Bob wouldn't put up.
Right? Really?
Yeah. Well, I think we technically ran out of room.
Uh-huh. Right. So how did it feel having these photographs? Very graphic.
I think you have to ask other people. I think you have to ask the people that looked at them, not me.
I mean, well, no, I think
I actually debuted those pictures when Brian and I spoke together at a TEDx conference here in Portland a number of years ago. I know that somebody stormed out of the gallery when they saw it, said it was really sick.
Really?
Which I find, well, that's not my problem. That's that person's problem.
Yes.
Our friend Richard Spear once commented that he thought those pictures were in somehow, some way that he couldn't explain, sexy.
Well, you know, I actually agree with him.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I should have a catheter more often and staples running through my body and PICC lines.
I don't know how to tell you this, but they didn't put me off. They did not put me off. You must have known that. You must have known that there was some element to the photographs that actually was not off-putting.
I don't think they are.
Yeah. Right. Along with everything else that is there. Were there other sculptures that are?
No, I think outside of the photographs of the pill, there was silk screens. There was large silk screen of one of the most famous, probably the most famous paper in the history of chemotherapy, which is the Sidney Farber paper, which he reported in 1948, the first remissions ever recorded for childhood leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
Which started the advent of modern chemotherapy. I did large silk screens of that paper. It was it was some effort with help from Drucker to get an original copy of the New England Journal of Medicine, that housed that article. And we did some silk screens of all the big words that oncologists use because they are confusing.
Mm-hmm.
That piece was based on the play Wit, where a woman, an English professor, is undergoing hardcore chemotherapy to treat breast cancer, and she's not only infuriated by her disease, by the effects of the chemotherapy, but most of all by her oncologist butchering of the English language.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a little fun. I had a little fun with their unique language.
So earlier in this interview, you talked a little bit about, you know, I took on Hitler and Mao and all these people, but, I mean, it was sort of not necessarily an avoidance of taking on this big elephant in the room, but I remember you had an article that came out, I think, with, you know, when your first exhibition happened, Goering's Lunch, you canvassed how Hitler saved my life. But then your life had to be saved over and over. I mean, do you ever look back at that particular article and say, he saved my life? And that was, I mean, in a way, that's such ancient history to what all has happened to you since.
Well, as many of my good friends, especially Melanie Myers, will say, I will do anything for attention.
Like,
so getting cancer twice, getting a pretty severe lung disease because of all the treatments I went through.
Oh, yes, you brought that up.
All that stuff. But, you know, it's, you know, and my old philosophy professor told me that he thought that my work was teaching people how to deal with monsters, whether it's a Hitler or a deadly disease. Because I've said it once, I'll say it again. Bad things don't mind being called bad things, or bad people don't mind being called bad people. They don't like to be mocked.
That's it. And that's what you were doing.
I don't think I was mocking cancer here.
No, not.
I was celebrating the people. See, I started the show that way.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I've done this before, and that I don't know if this does anybody any good.
It wasn't satisfying to you.
Well, I just didn't. I think the show could be bigger.
You had to face that.
Yeah.
Yes, and that did mean that you then ditched some of the things that you made, right?
I ditched a whole bunch of stuff that I made.
Right. And that ditch means, like, you didn't destroy it, you just didn't show it.
I didn't show it.
Yeah.
I have four more cancer shows in me if I released the B side of the show.
Uh-huh.
But it just doesn't stack up to what I think got accomplished with the show and hope to get accomplished with the show. You know, Brian is trying to find out ways that maybe cancer institutions can show some of the work.
Mm-hmm.
He wants some of the work for the hospital you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We'll just see what happens.
Well, did you find that there were people coming to that show at Ogden that were not your usual art people, I would imagine?
Yeah.
Right? And how was that for you? How did those people who don't have the art, the art part of the conversation?
I don't think I'd have ever been hugged or hugged back as much as I was during that month being in the gallery.
Nice.
Well, it was. I mean, I'm sorry.
It was good, huh?
Yeah. If it helped people deal with this disease, whether they have it or a loved one have it.
You've been both an ad man, successful ad man, and you've been an artist. And as I recall, you, by the time you did the, you did your show, your first show at Ogden, the Hitler show, you had already stopped working full time. Was that true?
No, I was still trying to do both.
Uh-huh.
And then Drucker and my psychologist said, you need to stop doing so much or you're going to die.
Right.
But, you know.
So you gave up advertising.
Yeah, but I returned to it in the teaching role because I didn't die. Yeah. I was supposed to die. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've said it before. Dan Wyden said it. That just proved I can't do anything right.
So, can we talk just a little bit about the difference? Do you mean the difference in being an ad man and an artist, or the similarities, or how do you see it? I would like to hear that from you.
That's a loaded question.
It is. Well, I've only got like about 3.5 minutes, but I gave you 3.5 minutes to answer
that.
Well,
the art and advertising both start with A.
Oh, come on.
They're populated by very opinionated people, a lot of self-important people, and too much money.
Both of them?
Yes.
But do you think when you're talking about art, you're talking about the art world, the
yes,
big art world.
That's,
many of us, I would say 95% of the artists out there in the United States, at least, aren't really operating in that world. I mean, maybe they were to the degree they got a degree or something, but after that, bye-bye.
True. I'm talking about the art world.
The art world, yes.
The big art world, the one that pats itself on the back for buying art and hanging money on their walls.
Hanging money on their walls. And do you feel like, I mean, you kind of crossed over into that pretty early on with your exhibitions?
In terms of?
Well, your exhibitions, when they happened, you crossed over into like being money on the wall?
Well, I don't sell anything, so I don't see how it's money on the wall.
No, I don't think you were pretty successful. I think your shows are pretty successful. So are you trying to, do you, though, in your work as an artist, do you see also similarities in your putting across an idea and selling an idea or in igniting a conversation?
Absolutely. And I'm not ashamed to say so.
Right.
Advertising is not a four-letter word.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's some other people in the art world that come from advertising. I'm in no way comparing myself to those people. But, I mean...
Are you talking about Andy?
Oh, Andy Warhol came from... of course, came from there. Hell, Jeff Koons used to be a commodities broker.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what Damien Hirst started at.
Right.
As a drunk.
Maybe that's it. Yes.
But, you know,
you don't feel like you have to defend it at all.
No.
Yes.
If people have a problem with it, that's their problem. It's not mine. I can't change my past.
So when is your piece going to be at the museum?
We install it Thursday.
Thursday it'll be there. Great. Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Ava.
I've been talking with Jim Riswald. He had an exhibition, Art for Oncologists, that we've been discussing. It was at Ogden Gallery. And he also has this incredible piece that will be at the Portland Art Museum later this week. My name is Ava Lake. Thanks so much for listening to Art Focus. I'll be talking with you in a couple of weeks.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Andy Warhol, looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol.
KABU is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KABU's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KABU Jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 19th year of the Portland Revels. The Portland Revels will perform 11 shows between December 6th and December 15th. That's the Portland Revels, December 6th to the 15th at the Scottish Rite Center in downtown Portland.